Everyone okay? Everyone good? Yeah? Okay, if you like to make any changes to the program or whatever, it's always okay to make suggestions if it isn't quite right. So I hope, as long as you're happy, yeah, reasonably happy, not super happy, because if you were super happy, you'd probably, you know, be meditating somewhere instead or something. Yeah, but at least reasonably happy, that's always good. Yeah, you are at ease, comfortable, enjoying yourself. That is what matters. So I will start off. I got a question. Sorry, what is your name?
Dave.
Okay, Dave. Okay, Dave just asked the question about what is the plane of neither perception nor non-perception. And as I mentioned, this is really about the four immaterial attainments in Buddhism. Yeah, so you have the four jhanas, which are the samasamadhi, and above that you have the four immaterial attainments, so that are even more profound states of samadhi. So this is where you go into samadhi that goes more and more profound. It's kind of moving towards cessation, which is the ending of everything, where everything stops. And that is called the sanya vidayata nirodha, the ending of perception and feeling. So this is the highest attainment before everything ceases. And the attainment before that is called the attainment of nothingness, the plane of nothingness. Yeah, so under Alara Kalama, he reaches nothingness. And then beyond that, because you already have got to nothing, I don't know if you can imagine, you have an attainment of samadhi where you are one-pointed and all your experience is nothingness. That's the experience. The experience is nothingness. It's kind of strange, isn't it, to imagine? You can imagine like maybe infinite space or infinite consciousness. It sort of makes sense, but the experience of nothingness, it starts to get very weird. And this gets even weirder still, because you are so peaceful, so calm, there is so little left that you don't really know whether you are perceiving anything or not. Afterwards, when you come out, you know that something happened, you're not really sure what it was, because it is so completely different from any ordinary experience. Yeah, and so neither perception, non-perception is kind of in the land between still being conscious and not being conscious. You're conscious, but it's almost as if you are not conscious anymore. And it's this kind of land between there somewhere. And they say that experience cannot be used for insight because you're actually not able to directly understand it because it is so subtle. So the last experience you can use for insight is the perception of plane of nothingness, because that is where you have a clear perception, a clear consciousness. Here, it is starting to fade away. So it is the name is strange, and the attainment obviously is even more strange. Yeah. So, and this is the reason why it is so different. You happy with that? Sort of. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah. There is only one way, of course, to really understand these things. You have to actually get there. But that's really the only way. So. Good luck. Eventually we'll get there. This takes the commitment, that's all. Okay. So now we have come to the point the Buddha has understood the problem with sensuality. And this is really the hard one to understand. This is very profound already. To understand the shortcomings of sensuality fully is actually very difficult. And the reason is because we all live our lives immersed in sensuality. From the moment you wake up in the morning till you lie down at night, everything is sensuality. The whole world around us is a sensual existence. The five senses is all we know. Yeah, seeing, hearing. And it's all about getting those in a positive way in our life so we can enjoy our existence. So the idea of living without sensuality is almost, it's hard to imagine, because it means the five senses are turned off. What is left when the five senses are turned off? Well, our whole existence is so much involved with the five senses, it's almost impossible to even envisage what it might mean not to have any kind of sensuality. And this is why what I'm saying before, it's so important to remember that sensuality, when we talk about that, we don't just mean like the coarse desires for sensual pleasures. We actually mean our entire existence in the realm of the five senses. So that's why everything we do is really about sensuality pretty much, except when you start to do some meditation practice. You start to give that up, you start to get some joy and happiness in your meditation. This is where you're starting to move out of that realm of sensuality. So this is already a very profound insight, and this is by far the most difficult insight to have. Yeah, because it is so. We are really are moving into uncharted territory when you move out of the realm of sensuality. So now the Buddha to be, what he is still left with is the problem of self-torment, because he still hasn't understood that. And that was quite clear from the way he was phrased in the previous one. He says that whether you experience pain or not, yeah, you can experience awakening. But now, so now comes the period of self-torment. We know that the Buddha went through this period. It is described in a number of suttas. But this is perhaps the most original and most relevant description, the one found in this particular sutta. So these are the practices the Buddha went through, and they are quite interesting in a couple of ways. So we'll have a look at that now. So the Buddha says, I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. This is like supreme willpower, using willpower, yeah, to the max, to crush your own mind, to bend it in a certain way. Yeah. So, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him and crush him, so too, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, a crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. So he's really giving it everything. He's using supreme, maximum energy to control his own mind. This is mind control. This is willpower taking to the highest extent. Yeah, and he doesn't get any result, because it says, although tireless energy was aroused in me and my mindfulness was well established, unremitting just means that it's established all the time, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. Yeah? But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. So here, this is just saying really that in a very extreme sense, that using willpower is not really going to work, at least not in its own right, yeah, as a path to awakening. The Buddha is here using it as a path to gain enlightenment, and it just doesn't lead you anywhere. You cannot suppress the defilements and then get rid of them in that way. That's really what he's saying here. You can't just get rid of them by suppression. You can't make awakening happening through an act of will. There is a different way to the path of awakening here. And this is a very important insight, because it means that we, instead of using willpower in our meditation, of course Ajahn Brahm is the one who always talks about not using willpower, and this is a good basis for that in the suttas, that actually, instead of using willpower, we use wisdom instead to guide our mind. And this, if you think back of what the Buddha has been doing so far, the Buddha to be has done so far, he has been using wisdom. Yeah, he's been seeing the danger in death and birth and all that. This is kind of the first. It's like wisdom. Yeah, you see the danger. That means seeing wisdom is not willpower. Then he sees the danger in sensuality. That is more wisdom. So he's using wisdom to turn away from the dangers of the world and move the mind in the right direction. So that is what he has been doing. And now, at the very end, he's trying to use willpower again to kind of gain the last release. Yeah, and this is where he goes wrong. Willpower is not really the path. Sometimes we may need to use a little bit of willpower, but most of the time, if we can, we use wisdom power, and we try to be smart and wise about how we use our minds rather than willing things into existence. What is interesting about this little passage here, I don't know if some of you may recognize it, but this passage right here is the same passage you find in the sutta called the Vitakka Santana Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 20. Vitakka Santana means the calming of thoughts. Yeah, this is Majjhima Nikaya 20, and it shows you five ways of calming the thinking mind. This is what that sutta shows you. It's a very beautiful sutta, and I often do it on a meditation retreats and that sort of thing. I won't be doing it this year. And the five ways of calming the mind, they are like hierarchical. It starts off with using substitution. It's a kind of way of using wisdom power. And then it goes through five ways. And the last of those five ways of calming the thinking mind is this way. Yeah, it's almost verbatim, exactly the same as this way here, which is kind of interesting. Right? So, because it makes you wonder. On the one hand, the Buddha says, well, actually, this doesn't work. Yeah? It's the wrong way. On the other hand, it's in the sutta where it says this is the path to overcoming the thought, the bad thoughts. So what is it? Is it against the Dhamma, or is it in accordance with the Dhamma? It kind of makes you confused. Yeah? Should we do this or should we not do this? And the answer is, I think, that here, this is given as a path in its own right to awakening here. Yeah, he's using this to try to reach awakening here. But actually, in the Vitakkasantana Sutta, it is only one out of five ways to overcome unwholesome thoughts. Yeah? And it is not only is it just one out of five ways, it is only a way to overcome unwholesome thoughts, and then beyond that, you have to do sammasati, satipatthana practice, and then sammasamadhi as well. And only then is awakening possible. So in the suttas, it's only a tiny bit of the path. Yeah, here it is the entire path in its own right. And that is the difference. Another important difference is that in the Vitakkasantana Sutta, where you find this passage, it is only the last of five ways. And if you know how the Dhamma works, the Dhamma is always hierarchical. It always has a certain sequence in things. So if it is the fifth out of five ways, it means it is the least important one. It is the very last one you should do if all else fails. That's what it means. So we start with using wisdom. Yeah, and then we use the other techniques there, which is like forgetting the bad thoughts and then allowing them to calm down by themselves. And eventually, if everything fails and you are about to murder somebody, okay, then suppress. Yeah, I must not kill this person. Okay, suppress, suppress, suppress. Then you use willpower. You know what I mean? Sometimes we are about to do something bad. We know we shouldn't do it, but it's almost like we can't stop ourselves. The wisdom is completely in turmoil. We have lost all our wisdom. I must not do this. What can I do? Okay, suppress. Yeah, I must not lie. Okay, suppress that idea of lying or whatever it is. Yeah, this is wrong. I'm going to go in the wrong way. Sometimes suppression is right, but it should be used with great care. Because otherwise it can cause so much troubles as well, psychological troubles. Yeah, if you go on suppressing your inner life all the time, it leads to, after a while, you start to go a bit crazy because you're suppressing everything, and it's not a nice thing at all. So this is the first one. Yeah, the Buddha, he calls it self-torment. Using too much willpower is self-torment. So then he gives that up because all it leads to is being exhausted. And because you are exhausted, you are uncalm. And if you are uncalm, there is no way you can gain real samadhi and peace inside. And for that reason, you won't be able to see anything. At the same time, the Buddha-to-be, he is very, obviously very, he has a very well-developed mind. So because of that, he does not, those painful feelings, they do not remain, invade the mind and remain. Which means that he is able to let go of these things very quickly. They don't actually become a mental obstacle for him, which it might do for most people if you did these kind of practices. So then he says, I thought, suppose I practice the breathing-less meditation, apanaka jhana. Apanaka means the jhana without breath. And this is one of the few places where the word jhana is used in a kind of pre-Buddhist way. And here it refers to a particular kind of breath control. Got nothing to do with jhanas as it is used later on to mean the sammasamadhi. Here it means breath control exercise. That's really all it means here. So again, the word jhana is used by the Buddha. It's a pre-existing word in the Indian culture, and the Buddha takes it to mean a specific types of meditation practice later on. So I practice the breathingless meditation. Suppose I stop the in-breaths and the out-breaths through my mouth and nose. While I did so, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. Just as there is a loud sound when a smith's bellows are blown, so too, while I stopped the in-breath and the out-breath through my nose and ears, there was a loud sound of winds coming out from my ear holes. So he basically started breathing through his ears. That's what it means. It's not a very good idea, is it? You can imagine this being pretty painful. But although a tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. It's kind of astonishing how determined he is. He really is determined on kind of finding a path. He is willing to take things to the absolute extreme. How many people would be willing to do this kind of stuff? You know, it's just, it's really. So this is why people get a bit impressed by, by ascetic practices or by self-torment. They are impressed by this because when you read these kind of things, it's almost superhuman to be able to do these things. And yet the Buddha does not call this superhuman. To the Buddha, the real superhuman is the insights that you have that lead to an end of all suffering. That is the real superhuman aspects in Buddhism. So although these things sound very impressive, and because they sound so impressive, have you seen the statue of the Buddha where the Buddha is really emaciated? Have you got that here in BGF? No, haven't got it here. Okay. So is that because you are especially wise here at the BGF? So what was that? You have your food. You love your food. Okay. If you see that, it turns you off your food. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. So, and what is interesting about that is that I think the reason why people have, and why organizations, we have this statue of the Buddha, or the Buddha to be, is because we are impressed by ascetic practices. Yeah. We think, wow, this is amazing. How could he do this? But actually, the Buddha said it's the wrong path. So when you have that statue of the Buddha to be, and you kind of, sometimes you people bow down to that, you actually, what we're doing, we're bowing down to wrong view. Is that a good idea to bow down to wrong view? It's a bad idea, yeah? So, I think this is not such a good idea. We can remind ourselves of this, that, you know, the Buddha did these things, and it's good to know that, but actually, we should remind ourselves that when the Buddha did this, he says later on, this was wrong view. He was on the wrong path while he was doing this. His striving was admirable, and he really took these things to the end. But this is not actually what the Buddha probably would want us to bow down to, because it is the wrong path, it's the wrong way. So it's good to keep that in mind, and I think sometimes and this is one of the reasons people are really impressed by ascetic practices, and that is one of the reasons why it is very easy to get taken by these things and start to be impressed by other people who practice very austerely and ascetically. But sometimes those people who are very austere and ascetic, they have actually lost the middle path, and they have gone down the path that actually is wrong, where there's too much self-torment, and it stops them from reaching awakening here, whether that is by sitting in postures for too long with enormous pain or whatever else it is. Sometimes these things are very counterproductive because you can't really relax. You can't be sabai, breathe in, sabai, oh no, breathe in, pain, yeah, oh, can't bear this any longer, yeah. That's what people often do, and this is problematic. So let us move on. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathingless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears. While I did so, violent winds cut through my head, just as if a strong man were to crush my head with the tip of a sharp sword. So too, while I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears, violent winds cut through my head, but all the tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was overwrought and uncalm, because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathingless meditation. So I stopped the in-breaths, out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears. While I did so, there was violent pains in my head. Just as if a strong man were tightening a tough leather strap around my head as a headband, so too, when I stopped the in-breaths and out-breaths through my mouth, nose and ears, there were violent pains in my head. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathingless meditation. So I stopped the in-breath and out-breath through my mouth, nose and ears. While I did so, violent winds carved up my belly, just as if a skilled butcher or his apprentice were to carve up an ox's belly with a sharp butcher's knife. So too, while I stopped the in-breath and out-breath through my mouth, nose and ears, violent winds carved up my belly. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and calm because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I thought, suppose I practice further the breathingless meditation. Jeepers, you're really going for it. So I stopped the in-breath and out-breath through my mouth, nose and ears. While I did so, there was a violent burning in my body, just as if two strong men were to seize a weaker man by both arms and roast him over a pit of hot coals. So too, while I stopped the in-breath and out-breath through my mouth, nose and ears, there was a violent burning in my body. But almost tireless energy was aroused in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was overwrought and uncalm, because I was exhausted by the painful striving. But such painful feelings that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. I'm not entirely sure what this breathless meditation is all about. It's kind of a little bit strange. You stop your breathing and you just see what happens. I'm not 100% sure what it is, but the point of this probably is that somehow you're trying to go beyond the body and find some kind of higher spiritual reality by suppressing the body completely. That's probably what this is about, you know, in a certain way. Because the spiritual existence must somehow lie beyond the body. And by controlling the body completely in this way, stopping the breath and all of that, it's almost like you're trying to get rid of the body somehow, and then through that move to some higher reality. I think that is a lot of the logic behind all the ascetic practices and the Atta Kilamatana Yoga that you found in India at that time, was that the body was considered the problem and you wanted to release that body. You did it by using all these painful practices that then would like counteract the normal bodily impulses and then somehow get rid of the body in that way. It's very interesting. You look at the history of spiritual practices in the whole world, and it's a very common thing, this idea of subjecting the body to pain. This has happened in Christianity, in Islam apparently. It certainly happens in Hinduism. In fact, all of these practices we're seeing now are really proto-Hindu practices, part of the Brahmanical culture at the time. So all of these things seem to be very deeply ingrained in human psychology. The idea that you overcome the body by torturing it in a certain way. That is probably what the Buddha is trying to do here. And then he takes it to really extremes, to the extreme that you probably can't take it any further. Took it any further, you probably would die from these things. So he doesn't do that. Fortunately for us, otherwise we wouldn't be here today if he had taken it even further. Okay, so then what happens is, now when the deities saw me, some said, the Rikrishgotama is dead. Others later said, well, if he didn't breathe, you can see why they thought he might be dead. Other deities said, the reckless Uma is not dead, he is dying. And other deities said, the reckless Gautama is not dead nor dying, he's an arahant. For such is the way the arahants abide. So they were all pretty confused. Yeah, they had no idea what was going on. Maybe he's dead or he's an arahant. You know, it's kind of very opposite ends of the spectrum a little bit. And so it shows you that the deities, again, they don't really have any wisdom. They didn't know what was going on. Yeah, the deities are part of samsara just like us, and they're trying to find their way out of problems and their own heavenly sufferings. Maybe not so bad, but a little bit of heavenly suffering probably they had as well. So the deities are really confused about what is going on here. And it just shows you that the Buddha took these things to such an extreme that people didn't really know what was going on anymore. It was just all getting very, very confusing and uncertain. So then the Buddha goes on to his next kind of ascetic practice. This is the last of the three kinds. So one is the mind control, the other one is breath control, and the last one is food control, is the last one. I thought, suppose I practice entirely cutting off food. Then the deities came to me and said, good sir, do not practice entirely cutting off food. If you do so, we shall infuse heavenly food into the pores of your skin, and you will live on that. I considered, if I claim to be completely fasting while these deities infuse heavenly food into pores of my skin, and I live on that, then I shall be lying. So I dismissed those deities, saying, there is no need. So, it's kind of a strange little thing, isn't it? What is this all about? Heavenly deities infusing, could they really do that? Is that really possible? I don't know, and I think it sounds a bit over the top, but maybe the point may simply be that the Buddha really is cutting off food, yeah? He's not messing around, he's not kind of pretending to do it while actually doing it a little bit, he is cutting it off fully. It may simply be to make a very clear point about that. That may be the main position on this. I haven't checked this against the other versions of this particular passage. I'm not sure if there is another version in the Chinese arguments of this, because as I said before, there is a strange anomaly because of the various schools in the Chinese arguments. But it's not, I don't think it's so important. The main point is simply that the Buddha is not messing around. I thought, suppose I take very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. So I took very little food, a handful each time, whether of bean soup or lentil soup or veg soup or pea soup. When I did so, my body reached a state of extreme emaciation. Because of eating so little, my limbs became like the jointed segments on vine stems or bamboo stems. Because of eating so little, my backside became like a camel's hoof. Because of eating so little, the projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. Because of eating so little, my ribs jutted out as gaunt as crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. Yeah, if you look at that famous, as I mentioned before, that statue of the Buddha, that's exactly what that Buddha to be looks like. Yeah, you see all the ribs. That's exactly, it comes from this description here. That's where that statue is made from. Because of eating so little, the gleam of my eyes sank far down in the sockets, looking like the gleam of water that had sunk far down in a deep well. Because of eating so little, my scalp shriveled and withered as a green, bitter gourd shrivels and withers in the wind and sun. Because of eating so little, my belly skin adhered to my backbone. Thus, if I touched my belly, I encountered my backbone. And if I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin. Gee, that sounds really over the top. Because I was eating so little, if I defecated and urinated, I fell over on my face right there. Anyway, because of eating... Because I'm eating so little, if I try to ease my body by rubbing with my limbs, with my hands, the hair rotted at its roots, fell from my body as I rubbed. So this is very extreme, isn't it? Really, really extreme. And of course, he must be very close to dying. And that's actually what he says next here. He takes these ascetic practices to the very highest possible point and can't really go any further. Now, when people saw me, some said, the reckless Gautama is black. Other people said, the reckless Gautama is not black, he is brown. Other people said, the reckless Gautama is neither black nor brown, he is golden skinned. So much had the clear, bright color of my skin deteriorated through eating so little. So that is the ascetic practices. And to summarize them, the Buddha says, I thought, whatever recluses and Brahmins in the past have experienced painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins in the future will experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. And whatever recluses and Brahmins at present experience painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion, this is the utmost. There is none beyond this. But by this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman qualities and a distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to awakening? So the Buddha has taken his experimentation with self-torment to the absolute extreme. He has stopped eating again, presumably to kind of reduce the body to nothing as possible, to see if the body somehow can be overcome by not eating. And he is on the verge of death. And of course, dying is not very useful. It's not going to solve the issue. But he hasn't actually achieved anything here. The austerities didn't work. And now he has found out sensual pleasure doesn't work. Austerities don't work. Neither of these things, these are the two extremes, in a sense. They don't work. So because they don't work, then he asks himself, he has taken both of those two extremes. He lived a very sensual life as a layperson. Now he lives the exact opposite as an ascetic. He has tried those fully. Now the question is there another way to awakening if these things don't work?
Ajahn Brahman, I do agree that self-torment is not the right way.
Yeah.
But only this way, I mean, he says here that Buddha said that painful feelings can't invade my mind.
Yeah.
Only through this self-torment or this kind of experience, he kind of gets to experience that my mind can't be invaded by these painful feelings.
Yeah.
So in that sense, certain level of suffering is needed in our practice to kind of experience that, you know, this kind of thing really can't invade my mind.
I understand your question. You need to practice in this way to find out that your mind is not invaded by painful feelings. But actually, you don't need to do that, you see here. This is kind of the nice thing here. You don't actually have to find this thing out. And the reason is, and if you read the things like the Anapanasati Sutta, it says that you start off with watching the breath, then you have the happy feelings coming from the breath, and there is no need, according to that sutta, anywhere to experience the painful feelings, because you transcend those painful feelings through the happy feelings. All you need is the happy feelings, and the painful feelings, they just disappear, and because they disappear, you have already an understanding of those, you gain an insight through their disappearance. The most powerful insights you can have into anything is when it disappears. Because when it disappears, you know, it is anicca, fully anicca. It is also dukkha, because when it's gone, you're happier. And also it's non-self, because you're not controlling it anymore. It's out of control. So you gain insight into the painful feelings through their disappearance, rather than through experiencing them in this way. You don't actually need that. Of course, if the painful feelings do invade your mind, it is very problematic, and that's when you cannot meditate anymore. Yeah, you meditate, and you have pains in your legs and your knees or whatever, and all of that, and you're not actually making any progress because of the pain. So instead of actually using that and then trying not to be affected by those things, which is probably part of what they do in the Goenka technique, where you sit down for an hour and a half, you have pains, and if you say, oh, I've got so much pain, okay, just watch it, yeah? And maybe it is possible to overcome the pain, for some people at least, through that way, if you have your mindfulness. But I think a far more powerful way is just not to get into that at all. Because get instead into a place where the body becomes insignificant. Because the body is really what you want to get rid of in all of this. Yeah, the Buddha also is trying to get rid of the body here in a certain way. The body is the problem. So you abandon the pleasure and the pain altogether. The body becomes irrelevant. And that is actually where you find the peace of mind as a consequence.
That probability of experiencing disappearing seems to be quite you know, distant from my level. I'm speaking for my own.
Yeah.
So then, in that sense, I mean,
yeah.
Just that, because the probability is so low, going through certain level of suffering or actually. You know, sitting, for example, for 2 hours on the floor and going through that pain and overcoming that pain, would that be a bit helpful? Or
I don't think so. I don't think it is helpful at all. I think it is just an obstacle. Because you, a lot of the time you are engulfed in the pain. The pain is just too much. You can't deal with it properly. All you're doing is enduring rather than actually being able to see it clearly. A lot of it is endurance. And there is no evidence in the sutta that this is required. The Buddha doesn't say it anywhere. Rather than doing that, it is much more useful to have a sense of peace in the body. That is where it's far more likely to find the joy and happiness in meditation, if you have a sense of ease and you are relaxed about things. So if you don't get that happiness in your meditation practice, it is not because you haven't had enough insight into pain. The reason is different. The Buddha doesn't say that's the reason. The reason the Buddha says you haven't got enough happiness in your meditation is because you haven't purified your sila enough yet. That's the reason. It is a message again and again in the suttas. If you look at what the Buddha calls the, dependent liberation. Yeah, there's a sequence of dependent liberation that the Buddha talks about in a number of places in the suttas. And he starts off by saying, first of all, you have the virtue. From the virtue of the sila, you have the non-remorse. From the non-remorse, you have pamudra, which is gladness. From the gladness, you have the piti. From the piti, you have tranquility. From the tranquility, you have the sukha. From the sukha, you have samadhi. From the samadhi, you have yatabuddha and anadasana. That's when you see things according to reality. And there's nowhere in that sequence that any pain is actually required. If you don't get the pamudra, if you don't get the gladness, you have to ask yourself, can I purify my sila even more? That's the question you should ask yourself. Yeah, and remember, sila is very profound in Buddhism. It is also about your mental states. It is about how much metta you have, how much compassion you have. Yeah, so develop those sides. And as you develop those, you change the way you think about things, you change the way you perceive other people, and also yourself and the world around you. Then it is likely that the happiness will have come in your meditation. You can bypass all the pain, go straight to the happiness. If you find that you are having success with a meditation that has pain, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. Yeah, if you feel that it is worthwhile and you're getting something out of it, then I can't tell you shouldn't be doing these things. So please do so. But I would encourage. In the end, the point is to gain the happiness that actually takes you to samadhi. Yeah, you want to go through that as well. You want to make that part of your path.
Not by their own choice.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that it helps them to actually obtain certain level of
medicine. Yeah. You're saying that suffering can be helpful because many masters have kind of gone through suffering in the life, and it can be, but suffering comes anyway. Yeah, you get suffering anyway, and you don't have to create additional suffering. I even as a monk, I have plenty of enough suffering in my life. I don't need to make any more suffering in my life. You know, it's not as if everything is just a breeze and always pure happiness. And so it is more about whatever suffering you have, use that wisely. And if you use the suffering in your life wisely, then it becomes very useful. And that's what I do. Whenever I feel I have a problem with other people, there's always problems with people. You know, this is what life is about. But you deal with that situation in a wise and skillful way, and you come out much wiser at the other end. You learn to look at the other person with compassion, with understanding, with metta. Use the difficulties in life. Already there's enough pain in the body as well. Yeah, sometimes use whatever pain you have wisely, then it becomes useful. But I don't think it's necessary to create additional pain. That is really what I... Anyway, that's the way it seems to me. Huh? Yeah. So, and I cannot see much reason in the suttas for believing that. The only reason really in the suttas is that you have the Satipatthana Sutta. In the Vedanupassana, the Buddha lists all the Vedanas, and one of the Vedanas he lists there is the Samisa Dukkha Vedana, which is like the carnal painful feeling. That's the kind of thing you feel when you sit, you know, too long in one's position. You feel the carnal or physical painful feeling, if you like. It's listed there, and you should understand it, he says. But it doesn't really say that you should deliberately try to, you know, make these kind of feelings. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah. Please, okay, now do whatever works for you. If you feel it works for you, do it. Yeah, I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but just you know, reflect on your situation, on the meditation, and learn from it wisely, and see if you can you know, whatever makes you progress is the important thing. As long as you reflect on it and you are careful with it and you do it wisely, then that shouldn't be a problem. Yeah. Okay, so time. I think you're right. So we have just come to this very exciting point about all the painful, all the austerities have been completed, and the Buddha asked these questions: could there be another path to awakening here? Yeah, it is just getting really exciting, and we have to call it a day. So call it get ready for lunch. So it's like one of those movies, yeah, they stop just at the right time and bang, and then you have to wait 1 week to get the next episode. Yeah, this is that kind of thing. So anyway, this is just to make sure you come back after the meal, yeah? So have a nice meal, and we'll see you again at around 1:30 here. Yeah?